Now our next guest has devoted her career to understanding why mass shootings happen, how to keep them from happening, and how to react when they do. She's a former FBI agent who was chosen by the organization to create its active shooter program after the deadly mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School in 2012. Police departments around the country have used her guidance in training programs, but sometimes those departments don't follow the recommended course of action. Police on the scene in Uvalde, Texas, waited 78 minutes to respond to the shooter in Robb Elementary School, raising questions about whether more lives could have been saved and why they didn't follow the protocol set by our guest of confronting the shooter as soon as possible. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you been trained in your workplace, whether that's a school or otherwise, on what to do in the event of an active shooter attack? Is this something your children have trained on in school? What questions do you have about how law enforcement responds to these situations? And what do you think about how to prevent them in the first place? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Catherine Schweit is a former FBI special agent who retired in 2017 after 20 years. She created and ran the agency's active shooter program. She wrote the book Stop the Killing, How to End the Mass Shooting Crisis. Catherine, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm really thrilled to be on Wisconsin Public Radio because Milwaukee was my first office as an FBI agent.
Really? Well, welcome back to Wisconsin via the internet. You wrote an opinion piece in the New York Times about the ways that law enforcement in Uvalde apparently didn't follow the protocols for active shooter incidents. Can you tell us how they veered off course from what you might have hoped they would do?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I wrote this opinion piece with a little hesitation, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. No one wants to criticize law enforcement, and as a law enforcement officer for a long time, I certainly didn't want to. But I also felt it was my responsibility to speak up and say, hey, look, law enforcement all over the country has been trained since the Columbine High School shooting in 1999 to go directly to the shooter when an incident occurs, because the people, you know, who are out there, you know, with the shooter, have no ability to protect themselves compared to law enforcement officers who come upon the scene. But I think what we saw in Uvalde is that reasons that we really don't have all the reasons yet, but we will get, for some reasons, the law enforcement officers did not confront the shooter until more than an hour after they first engaged the shooter. And that was it's just unacceptable in terms of how we train law enforcement. And I've heard truthfully from law enforcement all over the country saying the same thing.
A couple of things that have come out with the interviews with law enforcement in Uvalde was, I think the person we all thought was in charge of the scene said he didn't think he was the commander on site. How important is it to just know who is in charge, who's making these decisions?
Oh, it's kind of law enforcement 101. You have to have somebody in charge. And generally the rule in law enforcement is the first guy on the scene or the first gal on the scene is the first one in charge. And in this case, it not only happened to be the first one on the scene happened to be in charge, should have been in charge, but also happened to be the police chief for the very small department for the school police department, which has six people, not a very big department, but he was the police chief. He was first on scene with two local Uvalde police officers. And yet he did say in an interview that he felt like he wasn't in charge. And that's, from a law enforcement standpoint, a little incomprehensible, because that's exactly how you're trained. Incident command requires that whoever's on scene begin, take charge until the next person takes over.
Another point of concern, the judgment made apparently by the officers on the scene who were in the school at this point was that this was a barricaded suspect. The damage had already been done. There weren't lives to be saved anymore. And that apparently may have led to a lot of this delay. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, again, I think this is where I'm going to go back to just with a little bit of caution to say, mm-hmm. Department of Justice is, COPS office is going to go ahead and give us a minute to minutes, maybe second by second incident report that's going to help us to have a much better picture of who was where, when, and what they did. But with all of that caution for our listeners to appreciate that I don't have all the answers, what we do know for sure is that the officers failed to plow through and find a way to get inside. And although they got into many other classrooms and helped other children and adults out of the building, you don't have a barricaded situation when you have shooting underway. And there was a shooter, there was shooting underway, according to the chief and other witnesses, during that whole time, you know, off and on in that time period when they were stopped at the door and not moving through, looking for maybe better equipment to protect themselves or a key to get through the doorway. All of that is going to, I think, turn out to be incredibly unacceptable. And I do understand that sometimes law enforcement can say, oh, what's a barricade situation once we get to here? But the best information we have right now is that even once the officers stopped, they were fired upon, they didn't fire back. And then there was a time period and then there were more rounds exchanged inside the classroom and there was still no effort to move forward. Again, from a law enforcement perspective, that's just unacceptable, even though it's a very hard thing to ask a law enforcement officer to do.
Talking to former FBI Special Agent Catherine Schweit, author of the book Stop the Killing, How to End the Mass Shooting Crisis. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Kate, I want to zoom out from the particulars of the tragedy in Uvalde now. You are looking at all aspects of active shooting situations. And the best thing to do, it seems like, and you talk about this a lot, is prevent them from happening in the first place. What kind of things do we need to change, do you think, to make it so that we're not talking about police reactions, we're talking about not letting them happen at all?
No, you're right. You're absolutely right, Rob. You know, that's the situation, right? You know, when I put that book together, I found, as it turned out, that 10 of my 14 chapters were all about prevention, because prevention is the key here. And I think we have a very, as a whole, a very... we're very unaware of how much control we have over prevention efforts. While people want to look at what happens during an incident, I think if we look at before, which is the prevention part, we should know, you should know that, you know, FBI research shows 68% of these people live with somebody, meaning that somebody is around them. You know, 44% of them are employed. So we know people are around them and who sees the things. And so part of it is who can see something and help prevent it. Almost everybody, certainly family and friends. But in the case of FBI research, 92% of schoolmates specifically had the shooters leaked information specifically to the schoolmates. And that 92% was shocking to me. Then I went on to read the rest of the FBI's report on who heard about something and didn't report it. And it turned out that 87% of the spouses and domestic partners, 75% of the teachers and school staff. So a lot of people are hearing and seeing things and not reporting it, but it may be because they don't recognize what to see. What are those warning signs they should be looking for? And those really have to do with somebody who's disgruntled or who has a perceived or real grievance. So they are leaking and they're frustrated. They're leaking information to other people. They're frustrated because they want to have a right wronged, whether or not they really truly were wronged. That's part of the grievance aspect. But then there are visual signs too. They might change their appearance. They'll give away their things. 30 to 40% of these individuals are on the road to commit suicide, and they want to do that whether they finish it or not. So they'll give away their things. They'll stop taking their medication. They change their appearance. And they leave signs. They write notes. They write in their notebooks in their bedrooms. They put up signs on their walls. They put a piece of paper on the refrigerator. And it may seem like, how could you not see that? But we often... everybody, we always kind of, we think the best about the people that we love and live around. And we don't want to ever think that they're going to be the ones who do that, which is frustrating, but true.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Madison. John, hi.
Oh, hi. I had sort of an idea that there's, in the past 20, 30 years, that there's been an increase in wealth disparity, and that in combination with easy access to guns. And your guest just commented on the suicidal aspect of it and the grievance. And I just thought that was an interesting correlation between wealth disparity and easy access to guns.
John, thanks for the call. Kate, what do you think?
I don't have any research on that, and I try to really work with numbers, but I think that the wealth disparity may also be reflective of frustration that we see in society. We know that the kinds of stressors that have to do with, the FBI's research on the shooters themselves, 49% of them were suffering with stressors that involve financial strains. So absolutely, wealth is part of the issue. Probably mental health, job-related issues, and pretty much conflicts with your friends or your family are the other high-level issues that cause a stress. But financial stressors are right up there. Half of the people the FBI studied fell into that category. So, John, maybe you're right. You're right on the mark there.
John, thanks for the call. Kate Schweit is with us, former FBI special agent who created and ran the agency's active shooter program. She's talking to us about best practices for active shooter response, why they aren't always followed, and how to prevent active shooting situations from happening in the first place. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest? Do you want to see lawmakers change laws or policies related to mass shootings? What kind of trainings have you done in your own school, your own workplace? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation about active shooter prevention and response with Kate Schweit, a former FBI special agent who created and ran the agency's active shooter program. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. Let's go back to our callers now. Jim is with us in Dubuque. Jim, hi.
Hi. I'm wondering if your guest thinks it might be a good idea that school employees could be trained and allowed to defend themselves and the students with small arms, and whether she thinks it's just a coincidence that these shooting incidents we seem to be concerned about seem to occur in gun-free zones exclusively.
Jim, thanks for the call. You've looked at this issue, Kate, the idea of arming teachers and other school staff.
Yeah, Jim, thanks for the call, because I think that question, those questions come up quite a bit. And I think that one of the things I want to clarify is the idea that shootings occur in gun-free zones is a mistaken belief. So I just want, the listeners to appreciate that the data doesn't support that. Certainly, shootings occur in both gun-free and non-gun-free zones, or places where guns are taken all the time, but more of them occur in places where there isn't that type of prohibition. So that's the gun-free zone issue isn't really a discussion. And I say that I teach a class in the Second Amendment at DePaul University College of Law down in Chicago. I'm pretty familiar with the firearms and the gun regulations in and around the states. With regard to your first question, and I hear, I do hear several people often on say, should we arm teachers? Would that be a safer way to do it? And I think here's the kind of the concerns that exist with regard to that, Jim, understanding that, I was a law enforcement officer sworn for 20 years. I have a gun I carry. I know how to shoot. It's not about that. It's about the idea that almost every shooting in a middle school or a high school is a student at that school. A handful of them are students who have graduated. So what you're really asking a teacher to do is to raise a gun to one of their own students. And I think that many times, literally every teacher I've ever asked has said, I just can't do that. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't some locations where a teacher might be able to do that. But when a teacher hesitates to fire, then the teacher's going to be killed because it's going to be gun against gun. And I also know that, realistically, teachers get into that business to nurture. And so they're going to be inclined to see the best in their students and try to find a way to fix. So I think when we're looking, and I'm looking for big picture ways that we can solve this issue, for instance, in schools, and I mentioned before, in the school situation, there are twice as many of these types of shootings in businesses and places of business as there are in schools. So schools are about 20 to 25%, depending on what span of years you look at where these shootings occur. Those school shootings, that's a kind of a stretch, I think, to ask a teacher. And so to do that because of the emotional issues. But I'll give you this additional information, Jim. There are some states that allow that. There are some states that are doing that now. I think we don't have any data to see how they'll turn out. And I also, you know, as a person who carried a gun, also very concerned that you're bringing another gun into the scene. And when a teacher who is fired upon is killed, then there's another weapon with more ammunition in it picked up. And I've seen that occur. And also, you know, the things that other school people have been concerned about, which is, you know, can we get enough training for those teachers? Will the teachers be able to safely secure the weapon? So arming teachers is much more complicated, I think, than, you know, so I don't see that as the best solution forward, although I do believe that we need to kind of cobble our solutions together, Jim. So it's a good concept, but I think not something that we've seen a lot of success in the long run.
Thanks, Jim, for calling in, talking to former FBI Special Agent Kate Schweit, who created and ran the agency's active shooter program, author of the book, Stop the Killing, How to End the Mass Shooting Crisis. Back to your calls now. Donna is with us in Algoma. Donna, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just have a comment that I think that the gun regulations and law about the guns should be taken out of the Senate and Congress hands because they are so controlled by the NRA and the big money, and they do nothing anyways. I think it should be put to a vote for the public, to the public, and have it taken care of once and for all. And also, the teachers already are so full of responsibility, we don't need them to be armed and protecting our children.
Donna,
thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for the call, Donna. There's not a referendum process to do what Donna wants. But Kate, are there, as you look in ways to prevent mass shootings, are there firearm-related regulations that you think could make a difference?
Yeah, I'm no legislative expert, but I live outside of Washington, D.C., so I can pretend I'm one. Just kidding. There, you know, the concept, as you mentioned, you know, there really isn't a methodology to take that control away from Congress. That's the representative democracy that we have, is that Congress makes those decisions, and funds them. But in addition to that, right now, most all of the gun law that impacts every citizen out there is not federal gun law. It's really state gun laws. So I think one of the things that we may see and that might help is to have some federal legislation that really helps to kind of coalesce some of the laws that are supported around the country. One example of that is the proposal now for the red flag laws. There are currently 19 states and DC, District of Columbia, that have red flag laws that that's the nickname for them, but these extreme protection laws that would allow someone to go into a court and ask a judge to order that a gun be held from 6 months to a year, depending on the state law or more. And that would be, if there was a move, that's one of the things that's in the Senate. That's one of the things that's in the Senate and House negotiations, is to enhance red flag laws around the country and support them by providing the financial support for them. What that would do, I think, is to help to coalesce what is the most popular, which I think is your point, Donna, is if you look at the research on, you know, what did the numbers show Americans believe in terms of background checks, universal background checks, or red flag laws, or raising the age to buy a semi-automatic to 21, you know, when you can't buy a handgun at 20 at 19, but you can get a semi-automatic, you know, that's kind of questionable for me, I think. So I wonder if we could pass some federal laws that might to help coalesce some of the laws that exist in the states that might help to, again, incrementally kind of control some of the concerns without taking away the rights of people who are just abiding by the law, which is the majority of gun owners in the United States. But there's no question we have a lot of guns here, right? 400 million guns, 100 to 120 to every 100 people in the United States or something like that.
Donna, thanks for the call. We have just a couple minutes left, Kate, and I wanted to ask you about something else you've written about, how we train school staff and students to respond in this worst case situation where there is an active shooter. You're hoping to see some changes.
Absolutely. This is one of the things that I did, the reason I did write the op-ed piece in the New York Times. Back in 13 and 14, the federal government adopted the run, hide, fight as a national policy, just like stop, drop, and roll. That concept that, and I know from fact, from being at scenes and reading about and working on them, talking to law enforcement, that everybody at these scenes, when a shooting starts, they either run or hide or fight or some combination of that. But I'm very concerned and kind of frustrated that 10 years down the road, we're still primarily only teaching students the middle part, which is the hide part, which is lockdown. And I understand the concerns that schools have, but I'm hoping that parents and school districts over the summer will take the opportunity to reevaluate the ton of training that they give to the students and the faculty, because the faculty are the ones who are going to make the decision to run. And I can tell you that we know that, for instance, there were 9 children who survived when they ran out of Sandy Hook Elementary School in one of those classrooms that was being shot up. I know about children who jumped out windows at Virginia Tech and survived when their shooter was coming through the door. There are a lot of opportunities to run, but I don't think we teach our children to do that at any level. And the challenge to that is that we would run if we were in a movie theater or a mall or a park. But why do we leave our fate in the hands of somebody with a semi-automatic weapon who's coming through the door? I think I talk to my kids about that. I think parents should talk to their kids about that.
Kate, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Catherine Schweit is a former FBI special agent who retired in 2017 after 20 years. She created and ran the agency's active shooter program. She's the author of the book, Stop the Killing, How to End the Mass Shooting Crisis. She talked to us about gaps sometimes in law enforcement training and school responses when it comes to mass shootings, and some ideas on how to prevent them in the first place. Still time for you to share your thoughts and experiences maybe in these kinds of trainings. You can email ideas@WPR.org.